Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, June 24th. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, investing in the health care of the Saratoga community, announcing their second linear accelerator at its Radiation Oncology Center, Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Leslie Fishbein with Community Health Programs in the Berkshires. She is here to discuss psychiatry and mental health. The number to call with your questions is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein and your calls coming up on Vox Pop Medical Monday, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Leslie Fishbein, a supervising psychiatrist with Community Health Programs in the Berkshires, joins us today. Dr. Fishbein has worked at Boston City Hospital and Berkshire Medical Center in Pittsfield. She also maintains a private practice in the Berkshires. She earned her medical degree at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and completed her residency in psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine. If you have a question today, good time to call us right now. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
Are you a first timer on this program?
I am.
Well, I must say, and it's shocking that your CV was extremely brief for Medical Monday. Sometimes it takes up half the show. I know there's much more to it, but thank you for being so modest.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, great to have you here. What possessed you as a youth to go this route with your career?
Well, you know, it probably says a lot about me and my family, right?
Well, does it?
I'm sure
you
want
to get on the couch and we'll talk.
Is that a come on?
No, hey, oh, hey, not this early in the program.
Oh, good.
So anyway, I mean, this was something that called to you at a young age?
Apparently at 4 years old, I told my mother I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Really?
That means I knew what a psychiatrist was at 4 years old.
So you were a smart kid. But I mean, is it odd then for a kid at that age to actually follow through and
people tell me that it is, but I went forward trying to be a psychiatrist all the way through elementary school, high school.
Really?
At UPenn, I majored in biology of behavior. Yeah, I stuck with it.
Well, you have, obviously you were in residence at Yale University School of Medicine. Now you are in the Berkshires. What are you doing these days?
So I did make a bit of a career change recently, moving into consulting for CHP, which I'm very, very excited about. CHP is beginning to build mental health services where there have not been enough services for the Medicaid population in particular. And I'm happy to be able to consult with them to see if we can start to offer more mental health to this county.
What are some of those issues in behavioral health care these days that are key?
Not enough providers, especially not enough providers who can prescribe. It seems like it's everywhere.
Yeah.
I heard a statistic that only 40,000 psychiatrists exist now in the United States, I should say working psychiatrists, for the whole country. And a lot of them
How
are
many?
Near retirement age, 40,000.
That's a pretty high patient to
yes,
doctor
is.
Ratio.
Exactly.
I don't know if you can even answer this question. Is society now more stressed out than it used to be?
I think so. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I am seeing many more people come in with stress-related disorders, both physical and emotional.
Why do you think we are more stressed out?
I think it's a number. I think there are a number of factors. I think certainly financial worries are top on a lot of people's minds. Politics actually seems to be a big trigger for a lot of my patients, sort of re-traumatizing people who are already feeling helpless in their own lives and then feeling like they don't really have a voice or a platform currently.
Is there a media overload? Is this feeding the monster?
I have to say I sometimes prescribe no screen time. I've never said no radio time, though, but maybe I should consider that. Yeah, I do think there's overexposure and repetitive overexposure. It makes people feel helpless.
As a psychiatrist, you can prescribe medications, yes?
I can.
What percentage of your patients do you think need it and get it and otherwise just handle their problems with therapy and talking things through?
Mm-hmm. I think that by the time people get to a psychiatrist, they've already been through primary care docs or tried therapy without a psychiatric evaluation. So the percentage is pretty high. I'd say it's probably 95%.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. We talk psychiatry today with Dr. Leslie Fishbein. And let's jump on the phones here. And we go to Franny in Copaig. Franny, you're on. Hello? Hello, Franny. Are you there? Okay, Franny. Well, call us back. I'll not forget that name, and we'll put you right back on. Let's go over to Paul in Albany. Paul. Well, for Pete's sake, what is going... Joe Makowicz is our call screener, and he's sabotaging the show. Ann in Saratoga's on. Hello, Ann.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. I'm wondering if the doctor might have some suggestions. I have a child that recently returned home from college, and this was not something that was apparent to us before. But the child has explained that while at school, they discussed with a therapist possible OCD and seasonal affective disorder issues. And I have contacted the pediatrician for my child, but the pediatrician, to be perfectly honest with you, hasn't had a lot of suggestions in terms of medical staff or really, you know, information available for me. So I'm wondering if you have any, you know, suggestions and if this is also something that is frequently diagnosed at this age. It's not something that we are aware of. Beforehand, the child was a very strong student, mm-hmm. and it didn't seem to be, you know, something really apparent to us.
Okay. So, Franny, the good news is that OCD is very treatable with very high success rates, especially when it's a disorder that begins in the 20s and 30s as opposed to younger than that. 1% of the entire world population, no matter what country, has OCD. It's a very common disorder, actually.
Okay.
So OCD is treated in two main ways. The first is cognitive behavioral psychotherapy. It's a very well-studied, evidence-based type of therapy that isn't looking back at childhood and so on. It's really looking at ways to change thoughts and behaviors to extinguish either the intrusive thoughts or repetitive ritualistic behavior that goes with OCD. The other is that many SSRI antidepressants are very effective for OCD. These are common antidepressants like Prozac, Zoloft, etc. Very well tolerated and generally very effective.
Would that be a lifelong, then, prescription?
The OCD does tend to be lifelong, but as more skills are learned in cognitive behavioral therapy, people are sometimes able to go down on the dose and even off eventually.
Ann, thanks for the call. Now, what would bring OCD... That's obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm-hmm. What would bring that on later in life?
So 20s and 30s or even college age time is the highest or I should say the most common time that most of our psychiatric disorders begin.
Hmm.
So
do we
it's
know
not
why?
So late. Hard to say whether it's biological or in our society it's separation from family or both together. OCD does run in families.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest today on Medical Monday. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Do fears, be they rational or irrational, produce symptoms of psychiatric illness as well as physical illness?
All right. So do fears, whether they are rational or irrational, produce psychiatric as well as physical illness?
Sure. Great question, Jim. So I would say there are two main ways to think about this. The first is that worries and fears create stress in the body, which really has a physical effect on the body and can produce symptoms related to chronic high cortisol levels or high adrenal output. Such as heart disease, diabetes, insomnia, and other problems. The other way to look at this is that a lot of people are very suggestible, and in fact, a lot of excellent hypnotherapies rely on our suggestibility. And worrying, for example, if one has a brain tumor because maybe you just did a neurology rotation in medical school, would be kind of common. And, you know, you might have headaches, you might have some double vision. Just the suggestion of it can sometimes conjure up the symptoms.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Vox Pop Medical Monday. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is here. Dr. Fishbein is a supervising psychiatrist with community health programs in the Berkshires. Our number, if you have a question, is 800-348-2551. And let's see who has been waiting longest here. We go over to John in Chatham. John, you're on.
John, just your opinion and thoughts about the possible relationship between tick-borne illness like Lyme disease and sometimes serious psychiatric disabilities. I'll get off the phone. I'm just interested in your thoughts.
All right. Thanks, John. Well, this is a controversial subject.
It is. Clearly, Lyme disease in particular can manifest in the central nervous system, causing a number of neurological and emotional symptoms. Part of the controversy has to do with the difficulty in diagnosing Lyme when the titers are negative, and that's something that that has made the field of studying tick-borne disease kind of split into those who believe that a negative titer on a lab still can mean that a person has Lyme disease.
Yeah.
But certainly CNS, central nervous system Lyme, can be devastating, and the brain doesn't always recover from that infection very well.
Interesting that there are physical manifestations of Lyme. And one of the things that you did, as you described to me before the show, was when you were in residency at the school at Yale, right? You were involved with dealing with people who are in for surgery or just got done with surgery and physical problems manifesting in psychiatric ways.
That's correct. It actually took me all the way through my career until now. Worked for almost 30 years in hospitals as a consultant to medical surgical staff there to try to help understand what was going on with psychological symptoms in people who were ill.
Hmm. And you're happy now?
Am I happy now?
Yeah. You got out of there?
It's been very interesting.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is here. And let's go to Amanda in Schenectady. Amanda, you're on.
Hi there. I had a question about borderline personality disorder.
Sure.
About 11 years ago, my father passed away. And about 10 years ago, we had to admit my mother into the psychiatric hospital for her own safety. The doctors there had diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, and all of us, all of her kids, we researched it afterwards, trying to see how we could help. Wound up going to outpatient. For the last 10 years, she's been seeing a doctor that we're just finding out now doesn't believe in borderline personality disorder or bipolar disorder. He says that he thinks they're untreatable when you label them as that. But, through what we look up about borderline personality disorder, she hits like every single thing that you're looking for, and not like kind of a stretch, but like literally like hits every single thing. Mm-hmm. So should we be looking for a new doctor for her? Is that common that doctors don't believe in borderline personality disorder?
Before you answer this question, doctor, explain to us briefly what borderline personality disorder is.
Sure. Good question, Amanda. So borderline personality disorder is defined by a person's having primarily very labile affect. So the mood can become extremely reactive and very overreactive. Often from day to day, the mood changes, and the responses are so extreme that a lot of people with this disorder have tried to kill themselves, you know, have survived suicide attempts, have been violent, or have lost jobs. It's also associated with depression as a co-occurring disorder, and it's very highly related to an early experience of trauma, in that most people who have borderline personality disorder have had trauma, though not everybody who has trauma develops borderline personality disorder. I would say it's a pretty well-understood disorder. I don't know the specifics of what it means that the doctor doesn't believe in it. On the other hand, it's difficult to treat because we're talking about a personality that's developed in its own complex way over generally, you know, decades and decades. Psychotherapy can be helpful, and the one class of medicine that has proven effective is mood stabilizer medicine, as opposed to simply treating with anti-anxiety meds or antidepressants.
What is a mood stabilizer? Lithium or something like that?
Lithium is the oldest mood stabilizer that we have. We have more modern ones now, such as Lamictal, which is lamotrigine, Trileptal, which is oxcarbazepine, and a few others.
Amanda, you want to follow up?
Yeah, so just as far, like, what he said that, like, as soon as you label someone as bipolar or borderline, that means that they're, like, untreatable. And so he has re-diagnosed her with PTSD, you know, from childhood and also from my father passing away. But, like, I feel like through those, her emotions are still, like, taking the best of her and kind of taking our family down as a whole. So we would rather her get treated for what she has, which is borderline. And he kind of just said, like, oh, that was, like, a first-year med student who diagnosed her. It's not really what she has, and is, like, refusing to treat her for that. So it kind of sounds to me like we should probably find a different doctor for her.
You know, the one thing that does make sense about what you're describing is he's understanding the link between trauma and the development of this personality. And it sounds like he's trying not to stigmatize her with that diagnosis, which can carry a negative connotation.
Okay. And the treatment largely would be the same for PTSD?
The treatment really has to do with trauma therapy in general. So he's not really off track. It sounds like he wants to think about it in a more neutral way.
Amanda, thank you very much for the call. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest today. We talk psychiatry, and the number is 800-348-2551. Tom in Ballston Lake. Tom. Oh, it's line three again.
Hey, Ray, thank you.
There you are. Go ahead.
Thank you. There I am, yeah. Doctor, just a question. Our son is so overly sensitive to the least kind of criticism, and that's probably not even the correct word, but I just wondered, you know, how, you know, we could maybe best deal with this. Is she taking a gap year from college because she didn't know what she was going to do, and anytime we ever try to talk about anything, she goes into this defensive mode.
Okay. So how old is your son?
19.
19. Okay. So really an adult. Okay, good. I don't have to say I have no idea because I don't have children. you know, it's hard to know what could be going on as an underlying disorder. It's so broad. I mean, there's possibly an anxiety disorder or a mood disorder underneath that's making your son react in a more dramatic way than he might ordinarily have. I mean, has this been during his whole life, or is it more recent?
I think as he's gotten older, any time anything that kind of gets his ire up or whatever, I mean, there's more, you know, his hackles are up over something if, he disagrees with us, you know, me or his mom or anything.
Yeah. Is he willing to see a therapist to talk about what is going on underneath?
Well, I mean, it's we haven't even thought about that, yeah. But this might be good.
I think,
and we would be happy to bring it up.
Mm-hmm. And I think you could also potentially get a referral for him to have a psychiatric evaluation through the primary care doctor, especially if the doc knows him well.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. How do you like the show so far? You enjoy?
Having a ball.
Are you good? Good. Let's go back to the phones then. And Karen in Queensbury. Karen.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My sons were 7 and 10 when my husband came down with a terminal illness, which took a long time before he passed, like 10, 12 years. The youngest son seems to be stuck in a feeling like of abandonment. Mm-hmm. He's now 29. Mm-hmm. And you just don't ever get the feeling he's able to move on from this. He's always low, and he's tried different medications and CBD oil, but he's not seems to be his mood doesn't seem to rise up. You know.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry to hear about this.
Children never get
loss.
Over abandonment from a parent passing, and
I do think it's very possible. Generally, psychotherapy would be the treatment of choice. There are a number of therapies that can zero in on the trauma behind abandonment and help somebody process loss in that way.
Okay.
What kind of therapies?
There are a number of trauma-related therapies, and there's also cognitive behavioral therapy, which tends to be helpful for reshaping thinking, and that can reshape mood.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So he's been going to somebody like a licensed social worker, and he was just telling me he thinks maybe you ought to try somebody of your caliber, you know, mm-hmm. a more...
So not every psychiatrist actually does therapy these days. It does tend to be separated out. And some of the best therapists I know in our county are LMHCs, licensed mental health clinicians, and not even licensed social workers. So it really depends on reputation, I think.
All right, Karen, good luck. Thank you for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. And now we go to Stephanie in Wilton. Stephanie, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Stephanie.
While I was holding, I heard you don't specialize with children, adolescents. So I don't know if my question is going to be for you, but I'm going to go with it anyway. I have a 9-year-old son, almost 10. He has ADHD, moderate, combined. He takes dexmethylphenidate for it. He had a end-of-the-year school presentation on Friday, and it was a poem that the kids wrote that they were reading for the parents. And in the poem, twice he identifies himself as ADHD. And that's, like, the only thing he talks about besides liking video games. He doesn't talk about how he plays piano or he's in Cub Scouts or how he plays flag football. And that really upset me because say it once, that's fine. It's part of who you are. But say it twice, and I feel like it's dwelling.
Yeah.
So when I got home after thinking about it and kind of, like, stewing on it, I very quickly made a decision to tell him he was cured. So I said, hey, buddy, guess what? Presentation was great. I got a call from the doctor. You don't have ADHD anymore. Because we're going into summer and he's not going to be medicated anyway. But now I'm wondering if I made a huge mistake. Guess what happens in September if I have to put him back on meds because he struggles in school and if I should rescind my statement to him somehow.
Okay.
So I think there are a number of opportunities to help. I think one of the focuses needs to be Who are you besides that label? What do you like about yourself? And there's a psychology called positive psychology that actually Maria Sirois over at in the Berkshires and especially lecturing at Kripalu brings forth that I think is perfect for this kind of situation in which you're really developing a self-concept that's much more balanced. I think that it's worth looking at what the medicine can do and what the medicine can't do with your son so that he sees the limits of this tool and also the benefits of this tool so that he's more objective about it instead of feeling like the medicine's all powerful and he's not.
Stephanie, thank you for the call. And I know you don't work with children primarily, but in your estimation, are kids today over-medicated? In other words, kids can be scattered. A 9-year-old can be fairly scattered. Is there too much leaning on medications and diagnosis of ADHD?
You know, I'm not the best qualified to answer that. I guess the comments that I have are that this is a time when people are multitasking and very, very distracted by media, and that attention in general is going down the tubes. I can't really comment about whether medication is being overutilized or not, but certainly it can be very helpful in an immediate way when properly prescribed.
I guess my concern would be that 9, 10 years old, 11 years old, the kids are developing their personalities and developing and growing. And do you want to tamp down things that make them individuals?
I think that it really comes down to whether their self-esteem is suffering a lot because of their disability or if they are dangerous to other kids because they're so hyperactive. I think those thresholds when met really do merit consideration of medication.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. And Martha in Pittsfield, you're on.
Hi there.
I
have a family member who has an opioid addiction. And my question is, what resources do you recommend we go to for behavioral therapy?
Okay. Great question at a great time, because the Breen Center has just gotten a grant to expand its services for opiate dependents. And so I would highly recommend calling the Breen Center since they're developing a number of new programs right now and are wide open for referrals.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Maria. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. And now, it looks like a dead heat here. We go to Rob in Saratoga Springs. Rob, you're on.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding treatment of, like, continuous traumatic stress, PTSD, anxiety, depression, that whole kind of milieu of mental health disorders. What is your stance and background knowledge on the use of ketamine therapy, and have you heard of any promising treatment along with that? I myself do have PTSD, and I do a regimen of mindfulness. I do take sertraline and do energy healing, which I have found to be very beneficial. But I'm still looking for a degree, I would say, of relief. Given my profession, I know it's unreasonable for me to be anxiety and kind of depression free, just by the nature of my profession. So just curious as to your thoughts on that.
Thanks, Rob. That's a good question, and clearly you're up on the latest trends in psychiatry. Certainly, the treatment of depression with ketamine is seeming to be evidence-based, but it's very, very new. It's even newer for PTSD and OCD. The literature's pretty sparse. I tend to be pretty conservative, so I would not, for example, refer one of my patients with those latter two disorders for ketamine at this point.
What does ketamine do?
Hello.
Okay, hang on a minute, Rob.
Yeah, ketamine is an anesthesia, actually. It comes from that realm of drugs. And it produces what's called a dissociative state, so that it's almost like tripping in a way. It's how a couple of my patients have described it. And it seems that that sort of dissociation during the treatment can be very healing for depression. The mechanism of how this works, I don't know.
So this is like shock therapy to some extent?
It's chemical therapy. I mean, it's an infusion, generally IV. There are some communities who have a nasal spray available, but it requires a big setup in the outpatient realm.
Go ahead, Rob.
You say that it's a dissociative state that occurs. Would somebody, find that to be an addictive kind of effect, maybe?
You know, I don't think it's so much addictive as it sort of worries me, because I worry about what kind of dissociation can occur. You know, could it be negative as well as positive if you have a trauma background? Again, I'm far from being an expert on this.
That's interesting, though. You know, you mentioned that there is some literature, although not much, in treating depression with this. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me that they say Cary Grant took a lot of LSD back in the day for his depression. And I assume there wasn't very much literature on that.
Right. Interesting. There is some relatedness between these two compounds, LSD and ketamine, in that they both can cause that kind of dissociation and kind of tripping, for lack of a better word, dissociation.
We have to take a quick break here. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and it's Medical Monday. Dr. Leslie Fishbein is here, and she is our guest. Your mic was off, so whatever you said, I didn't hear it, and it's okay. Zach didn't hear it, so whatever. As long as you didn't swear, I think we're A-OK. Let's jump back on the phones here, and Carmela in New York City. Carmela, you're on.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call, actually. Good afternoon. The reason why I'm calling is because I have a friend that her 45-year-old partner passed away. They have her on Zoloft, Xanax, Prozac, also Seroquel, and she just cannot get past him passing because she feels guilt that she wasn't there when he passed. So I was wondering if there's anything we can do or something else or how we can help this woman.
Yes, Carmel, I'm sorry to hear that. It sounds like a really painful situation, and those are, you know, significant medications that she's on. What you're describing sounds a lot like what we would call complicated grief. And grief becomes complicated and much harder to break when there was some kind of conflict around the death that's produced either guilt or anger that hasn't been resolved. And so
they had a fight before he passed. She left, and when she came back, she found him dead in the bed.
Yeah, that's a pretty pretty regular kind of setup for this kind of grief. Psychotherapy really aimed at the complex nature of this type of grief is my recommendation.
Well, she is in therapy. She goes to psychiatry and to regular therapy, but she just can't get her out of it. It's been almost a year and a half.
I think, again, that therapy that's sort of specialized to get at a complicated grief picture would be important. And there are a number of trauma therapies, parts therapy, and other therapies that I'm not as well versed in being a psychiatrist that may get to the bottom of this in a more expedient way.
All right, Carmela, thank you for the call. As a psychiatrist, how do you deal? And I guess you could ask this to any doctor or surgeon, whatever. The client that you can't help, the person who can't pull themselves out of it, or you can't help them. Mm-hmm. How do you compartmentalize that?
You know, generally, I think there's always something to try. At least that's how I feel. I mean, here and there, there's a stalemate where, you know, a recommended treatment just is not received well, or medications have been exhausted, and I might be recommending ECT or TMS when there can be kind of a, I hate to say stalemate, that's the word that's coming to mind, and sometimes getting a second opinion can break that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Dr. Leslie Fishbein. The number here is 800-348-2551. We go to Bob in Broad Alban. Bob, you're on.
Thank you, Dr. Fishbein. I have a question, and I've just learned that you are not a specialist in adolescent psychology. I have, I'm a single man, not having any children, over the age of 70. I am aware in three families of their children, girls aged 13 in the seventh grade at the same school, who are absolutely refusing to go to school. But they do not mention anything of bullying or threats by boys or any other kind of threat. I wonder if you have ever experienced something like that. And I have an additional question with respect to adults and any written test to identify the sociopathic personality.
Okay.
One at a time.
Yeah. So the first question, you know, I like you, wonder whether there's been something that's gone on at the school, whether it's bullying or some other kind of predatory behavior, you know, on the part of students or staff, because it's not something I've ever heard of myself. In terms of diagnosing personality types, there are a number of personality tests, the most famous of which is the MMPI, the Multiphasic Minnesota Personality Instrument. And that is used at times to help psychologists zero in on personality types like the sociopathic.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Jen in Williamstown. Jen.
Yes, hi. I think thanks for taking my call. I think you touched on what I wanted to ask about, which is intractable depression. Mm-hmm. We have several family members who are really struggling to deal with some depression. They've tried talk therapy. They're on they've tried meds. There are a lot of side effects on the meds, mm-hmm. So they can't necessarily tolerate for a long time. And we've struggled to find really good treatment in this area. So I wondered if you have any suggestions about that. Also, I wondered if you would talk a little bit about some of the, I think you also touched on the shock therapy, which, of course, has such a stigma in our mm-hmm. society right now with right. memory loss and maybe unrealistic representations of it in the entertainment industry.
Right, exactly. Yep. So the question really is, what do we do with treatment-resistant depression? I don't like that term, but that seems to be the term in the literature. I have a couple of thoughts. One is sometimes a genetic profile, for example, one that's done by GeneSight, GeneSight, can help look at the genes that may predict metabolization of certain classes of medication. So, for example, if rapid metabolization of medicines runs in the family genetically, the folks that are being treated may never get therapeutic levels. And if, on the other hand, they're slow metabolizers of certain medicines, they're going to have a lot more side effects. And so when you've got a situation like this, especially in a family, I would be looking to get a GeneSight test. Mm. They're very easy. It's a cheek swab that can be done in the office. And so I would look to see if you know anyone who does that. When that's done and all of the medications tried have failed or not been tolerated, there are other options. A less invasive option is what's called TMS, for transmagnetic cranial magnetic stimulation, which is basically a series of treatments 5 days a week for about 6 weeks. Of a magnetic pulse to the part of the brain that responds in depression. So it's, you know, it's generally one side of the head in a specific spot.
Do they know why that works?
It stimulates the cingulate gyrus, which is implicated in depression. Yeah, we know that the cingulate gyrus in depression is generally underactive, and the stimulation by magnets as opposed to electric current seems to be effective in about 40% of people.
So worth a try in a tough case.
On the other hand, electroshock therapy, which I can talk more about it in a bit if you'd like that, is 85% effective for treatment-resistant depression. And so when things are really tough, I generally go that way first.
Dr. Leslie Fishbein is our guest. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok today. The number is 800-348-2551. And Lisa in Grahamsville. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. I've been treated for depression, anxiety, and PTSD for years. We've finally hit on medications that are working, but I was on a medication called Klonopin for a long time. I was weaned off it as of Memorial Day weekend of this year, and I'm finding within a week of that weaning off, my mouth is numb. I have very little sense of taste, and my lip goes numb periodically. I was wondering if that was kind of a withdrawal sort of thing from that medication.
Klonopin or clonazepam, which is the generic, can be extraordinarily difficult to come off. And the longer this medication has been out, the more motor and sensory side effects we've seen on it, and the more we've seen as people come off. Generally, the only way to get around this is to come off as slowly as possible, 10% every, few weeks or 10% a month, and it can take a year to come off. Unfortunately, that class of medicine, benzodiazepines, is being used less and less in the wake of the opiate crisis, even though it's not an opiate, because it is a sedative hypnotic.
Right, because my doctor did want me to come off it, which maybe I weaned off too quickly. But would these feelings of numbness and stuff go away after a while?
Yes,
or should
they
I see a neurologist?
No, they should.
Well, that's good.
Okay. Yes.
All right, Lisa, thanks for the call. We go now to Robin in Schenectady. Hi, Robin, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, that touched on my question, especially in kids. I guess one of the big cases about medication was the Eleanor Reese case. And even if you're taken off medication, the cumulative effect can be so severe, and it's usually going on and off medication. You think you go off it and the side effects are going to go away, but as they understand it, they can be permanent and cumulative. So especially in kids, isn't there a serious issue with everything from cumulative brain damage to organ damage with the various medications?
I'm not aware of the case that you're referring to. Certainly,
it was the landmark case about forced medication back in the 70s.
Oh, 70s, uh-huh. Okay.
It was a very famous case in the 70s. She discussed the importance of being able to, who knew better,
right,
the side effects, the effects of the medication, and the tremors and the permanent bladder damage that she suffered to help stop the blanket. Yeah, so she's very famous. It's the Civil Liberties Union. It's a Civil Liberties Union case.
Okay.
But in kids, this is the big issue because there's been such an increase. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
I think that the medications that we have now are certainly superior to the medications that we had in the 70s. But there are some that are safer than others. The antidepressants seem to be much safer than, say, antipsychotic medication, for example.
All right. Well, thank you for that one, Robin. We appreciate it. Andy in Vermont. Andy.
Hey, I'm not a high energy guy, and I'm an extrovert, and I work in information technology, and I seem to be on the analytical side. I can sit and read books for hours on end, but when I'm at work, I can't block out conversations around me, and I can have issues concentrating. I often code while smoking pot. I know, don't laugh. Because it makes it easier for me to sit in front of a computer for hours on end and grind through code and concentrate.
Yeah.
When I get home, I like some beer and wine and have a great fondness for the weed again. And I often don't get angry, but I can wind up really quickly, and then I let it out and de-escalate quickly. It's kind of like a thunderstorm. And I think something's going on, and I've done some reading, and I don't want to prime you on my self-diagnosis, but I'm kind of wondering what you think.
So I'm hearing that you're having trouble sitting for a long period of time in front of the computer. That's the main challenge.
Oh, well, and the temper thing's really not the greatest thing for my social life.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's a very broad issue, so it would be difficult for me to comment without seeing you personally. Certainly, the use of alcohol can be associated with exaggerated emotional responses.
Yeah. All right, Andy, thanks. Not a lot you can do over the phone.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, thank you for that one. And now let's go to Jesse and Troy. Jesse, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question. As somebody who wants to help somebody else who has an issue, I had a friend who was suicidal and was hospitalized a couple of times, and I just felt really out of my element as far as being able to help and being afraid I might be doing more harm than good and not knowing what to say. And I was just wondering if there are resources or even you know, therapy specifically for somebody who wants to help somebody else,
yeah,
not necessarily my own issue, but wanting to help, you know, someone else with their issue.
You may be interested in training for manning a suicide hotline, for example, with the Samaritans. There's also training for women in particular for battered women hotlines. So you might look into some community offerings that will train. That may be a good place to start.
All right, Jesse. Very quickly, let's go to Mary Kate and Troy. Mary Kate, you have about a minute here.
Hi. Okay, thank you. Just a comment on the electroconvulsive shock treatment. My sister is severely bipolar, and I was in touch with her psychiatrist. We were, you know, desperate because she had tried so many meds and nothing was working. She also was a terrible alcoholic, but he said that the shock treatments are the safest, most effective treatment for severe depression and bipolar. And sure enough, she had, I don't know, maybe two or three treatments, and it was amazing how much it helped
her.
All
right.
Have you heard anything?
Yeah, about 20 seconds, doctor.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's one of the most effective treatments we have for depression. I would just add that we have to be very cautious using ECT when there's bipolar disorder because it can promote cycling into mania even without that history of bipolar.
Well, Dr. Leslie Fishbein, we're done. That was a fast hour. Thank you for being with us today. Support comes from Tanglewood. Andras Nelson's conducting the Boston Symphony Orchestra with violinist Anne-Sophie Mutter in works by Dvorak, Joan Tower, and Previn on July 6th. Tanglewood.org for tickets. Thanks again for listening today and for the great calls and everybody who checked in. Thanks to Dr. Leslie Fishbein of Community Health Programs in the Berkshires for joining us today. Thanks to the inimitable Zachary Malloy, our engineer. The phones are answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Now, we've done psychiatry. Tomorrow, we'll do meteorology. Jason Goff will be here to answer your weather questions. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.